Thank you, Daryl. By the way, I should tell the people that my book is called The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America, and it will be published by Dandelion Books probably early December this year.
Well, it sounds like the kind of relationship that we have been discussing on the French Connection for a long time, and it's interesting to note that its history goes back some years, and we're not going to be discussing that much of it today, but you know, we discussed Morgenthau and Brandeis and whatnot in the early part of the century, but this is kind of a culmination of policies that the Zionist community have put into action, and basically it your story kind of picks up its steam in the 80s. You want to pick up where in the 1980s what was happening in the country that you see and what kind of problems were becoming evident at that time?
Well, let's just back up 1 second. There are three strains of anti-democratic reaction in the United States that have essentially taken over the country. And they came into power imperceptibly, and they came into power with the great approval of the American public. These three strains had long existed in the United States, but they had never really been in the forefront of political spectrum. They had been in the background, or they had been marginalized. But in the 1980s, what happened was Ronald Reagan came to power, and he came to power in a manner that was entirely democratic on the surface. But what he did was he brought into power a fascist cabal of Zionist Jews, evangelical Christians, and Straussian economists, the three of which managed to bring about an anti-democratic revolution that has been that has gone on imperceptibly. People to this day do not believe that the United States began to die in 1980. The reason for that is obvious. The superficial belief, superficial appearance of America is the same today as it was, say, in 1925 or 1961 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The trappings of America, the symbolism, the electoral system, the flag, everything looks the same. But what happened in 1980 is that the United States died because at that point, the U.S. began to embrace beliefs that were directly antithetical to the founding fathers' notions of liberal democracy, because at root, the United States is a liberal republic, and that is something most Americans could not understand if you tried to explain it to them. What happened in 1980, you really have to understand what the previous decade and why the American political culture collapsed. The Vietnam War engendered an anti-war movement, and the anti-war movement was something that a lot of conservative Christians found distasteful. A lot of very left-leaning intellectuals, particularly of the Jewish faith, found that they could not support the Democratic Party any longer because they were bringing in federal legislation that was essentially federal spending, federal social spending, which was opposed to their notion of the government not feeding and enabling the poor elements of society. To put it bluntly, the Straussian economists and the Zionist Jews are very difficult to separate because they came out of the same group of people. Irving Kristol and Norman Bud Horowitz are two particularly notable ones.
Yes.
And these people began a campaign against Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, the war movement, the anti-war movement, all of which were wrapped up in the Democratic Party. And a countercurrent of reaction set in. And this was, of course, a very fringe group of what are now called neoconservative economists. They would write economic screeds in defense of individual rights, anti-statist positions, and they would join forces ultimately with Christian radicals who were essentially really anti-abortion, pro-prayer, and this sort of thing.
Well, some of the people that we've investigated within that Christian movement have very strong ties to Zionism, and the marriage between the word Judeo-Christian began to become more prominent in this period as well. So in other words, right now you don't separate the interest of the Judaic side of this equation from the Christian side, and that kind of thinking has actually started leaking into all the Christian movements across the country.
Well, the thing is, you have to be careful when you speak about Jews and Christians, because the Zionist Christian community, evangelical community, is really an aberrant belief system. And for the longest time, it was considered out of the mainstream and not very credible. It is based upon a very eccentric belief system that comes from John Nelson Darby from the UK. And I won't go into great detail about this, but he's the one who exported it to the United States.
Is he the guy that wrote the Schofield Bible, or had the Schofield Bible codified?
It wasn't him. The Schofield Bible is based on his teachings.
Okay.
Yeah, but John Nelson Darby was the progenitor of the movement that essentially brought evangelical Christianity to America. But the upshot of that is that these people are not real Christians in any intellectual sense. They're Christians in a very militant, I would say sociopathic sense. And they have an affinity with the radical Zionists who do not represent mainstream Judaism. These are essentially also militant, eccentric sociopaths who read the Bible in a very bizarre, literal way that somehow that Israel, Palestine is a private land grant between God and the Jews, which is Satan rubbish.
Yeah.
But if you look at, if you treat Palestine in this manner and think of Jews and Christians as God's gift to humanity, then you tend to create a very egocentric, chauvinistic, bigoted attitude toward people who do not share your point of view.
That's right.
And when you combine this with the essential selfishness, the robber baron mentality of the Straussian economic movement, which goes back to Leo Strauss and Irving Kristol, then you have a very toxic brew of economic selfishness, moral bigotry, and rabid militarism. And this is the train of, this is these strains came together after around 1973 and sort of fused together slowly from that period until Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980. Now, 1973, you recall, was the year in which the Supreme Court of the United States passed the Roe versus Wade decision.
That's right.
Abortion legal on demand. And that was the same year that the Heritage Foundation was started by Paul Weyrich. And the Heritage Foundation was the first of the so-called conservative think tanks for think tank read propaganda facts.
Can I also interject something else, that this is kind of a socio thing that was thrown onto the country as well? And it may sound bizarre to you, but 1970 to 73 is when pornography became acceptable within the society, where before this, the U.S. society found that that was not within their interest of morals, and all of a sudden it was coming from every corner. In other words, there seemed to be a plan from behind the scenes to begin to degrade the morality of the country at that period as well.
Well, you're quite right that pornography became far more prevalent, but I think that's the reaction not to any sort of concerted effort to promote pornography, but as a reaction of the repressive moral climate of the 1950s. I mean, the 1950s was a horribly repressive decade. If you look at the Leave It to Beaver stereotype of the family and the idea that you couldn't talk about sex. I mean, this was a very repressive environment, and the 1960s was a reaction against this. Like the pressure cooker lid blew off and all hell broke loose. And the rise of pornography ended up being caught up with free expression and the First Amendment.
Yeah, but all of the people behind the push for pornography in the San Fernando Valley and across the country happened to come from the Jewish community again. Now, is that a coincidence?
I don't know that it's a coincidence. I don't know that it's relevant.
Well, it seems to be a bizarre thing, because there's also some other degradations of moral character in the country's history that are also fomented from this same group. And I'm wondering, you know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, I start to think it's a duck.
Yeah, but I think you have to look at the whole animal. And I'm not sure that looking at a Jewish conspiracy behind the rise of pornography is terribly productive at this point.
Okay.
So the only thing to look here is that the rise of pornography gave the Christians something to latch on to. That is abortion. And that's what they used to start their campaign against what they called the moral laxity, the loss of values in America. And it tended to get a lot of resonance with the radical Christians.
Yep.
But at this point, they were still on the outside of respectable political society.
Mm-hmm.
The first time they tried to get their spokesman into politics was in the 1976 general election with Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan lost out to Gerald Ford. And Ford lost by a squeaker to Jimmy Carter. Matter of fact, it was the shortest smallest margin of victory since Woodrow Wilson beat Charles Evans Hughes. It was an extremely small victory. Matter of fact, if Gerald Ford had won that election, I would be very interested to see what would have happened to the United States, because because what happened with Carter, although Carter was a decent man and I think one of the most intelligent presidents America had, education-wise, he was a Baptist Christian, and his Baptist Christian background made it respectable for fundamentalist Christians to proclaim their faith and take up a political position. Because until then, they had to soft-pedal their radical beliefs, because they were essentially held in very high odor by respectable, moderate Republicans and Democrats. So with Carter, who I think can't really be blamed too much for this, but his election was a significant event. It made it possible for the Christians to come to the fore. And the Christians and the Straussians had a common belief in the Protestant work ethic and the anti-statist welfare state mentality that also found favor with the radical Jewish group. So by the time Carter comes to power, there's this groundswell of reaction And essentially things started, the wagon came off Carter's political campaign in 1977 when he spoke of the need to for the Palestinians to have their homeland and to live in peace and security. The Israel lobby went berserk, condemned him. Carter tried to backpedal and did it very poorly. And when you consider that he had to deal with the Iran hostage scenario, the hyperinflation of the time, his presidency was essentially cursed. And so by the time Ronald Reagan is going to run for power, anybody could have beaten Carter. Even though Carter was an intelligent man, anybody the Republicans put up could have won. And the funny thing is that Ronald Reagan was not really supposed to be the standard bearer for the Republican Party. It was supposed to be Jack Kemp. Jack Kemp was the apostle of a new group of supply-side economists that wanted to essentially turn the clock back to the 1920s and let the robber barons take over again. But Jack Kemp was not very electable, so he made a deal with Ronald Reagan that if you support us and give us control of economic policy, we'll throw our support behind you. And Ronald Reagan, who never really had an original thought in his life, said, sure, we'll do this. Because Ronald Reagan was a movie actor who went into politics armed with a strong sense of Christian rectitude and little else, found himself instantly in front of the Republican Party, and he walked into power spouting jingoism, denial, and all sorts of platitudes that the American public laughed up. And they laughed it up because they had been beaten and insulted and stepped on the last decade and a half because of Vietnam, and they didn't want any more of it. So what happened in 1980, the American public put their brain in their hip pocket, elected a B-movie actor to become their president, and in so doing, allowed a contagion to enter into their political culture. And that contagion would metastasize throughout all aspects of society to the point now where the United States no longer exists.
I agree that we've lost all of the value systems that I ever knew were important to me growing up. And what I see, it's not only in social or moral or financial or foreign affairs. It is in every single thing that you can possibly mention. It has all been negative. Not a single positive force has resulted in any of these things. And I'm wondering now, when we get to this 82 area where the Netanyahu's documents and the beginnings of some of these more radical ideas are starting to find their way into government, what can you say about that?
Well, Netanyahu wasn't around in 82. I think you're looking since about 92, aren't you?
Well, there was a plan in Israel put together that was only a white paper type plan,
yeah,
that started talking about a larger role for America in putting Israel first within the world and in both Middle East area and the United States, and the change happened dramatically in the early 80s.
Well, in 1980s, the Israeli journalist named Oded Yonon wrote a piece that talked about Israel's greater interest in the Middle East, and that had to do with controlling Iraq, Iran, Syria. It was essentially a statement of intent that Israel wanted to assert itself throughout the region. And throughout Reagan's government, although he appointed no Zionists to cabinet positions, there were many of them Israeli citizens who were at the policy level, and many of them, like Edward Luttrell, ended up making policy for America, and slowly the Israeli first focus of American Middle East policy came to dominate Reagan's thinking. Now, Reagan was a decent man. I don't think he was a bad man, but he wasn't a very bright one. And what happened, there were at least three occasions during his first term of office where he opposed Israel and was slapped down hard for it. He told Menachem Begin to get out of Lebanon in 1982, and Menachem Begin slapped Reagan in the face with some Holocaust imagery that had nothing to do with anything, and Reagan took his medicine. In 1981, Israel bombed the Ozeritz nuclear power plant in Iraq,
in direct violation of American law, whereby the United States does not permit Israel to use any American weaponry it buys for offensive purposes. It was swept under the carpet, and then Secretary of State Alexander Haig pretended the whole thing was existed. And then later on, it was Reagan getting slapped down because of Palestine. He told the told Menachem Begin he didn't want any more settlements to be built. He wanted to stop the settlement construction. So what does he do? What does Menachem Begin do? He announces more settlement construction and essentially humiliates Reagan. And it's at this point that you start to ask yourself, what is going on here? I mean, why should the United States, the strongest, most powerful nation in the world, why is it being beaten up and humiliated by this little insignificant fascist state on the eastern edge of the Mediterranean? And you have to ask yourself, well, the United States wouldn't willingly do this. I mean, no country allows itself to be bullied like this. The only conclusion you can come to is that the United States wasn't really in control of its own government. And that's
well, this is when AIPAC and the lobby and Kahana and all of his crazies out of New York began to really exert themselves both with their financial muscle and their control over the Congress and Senate.
Well, this is that's something I don't go into my book too much. I treat the period of 1980s as a preparatory section to get into the Clinton Bush era, the Clinton W era.
Mm.
But the issue of the rise of AIPAC is significant because throughout the 1980s, there became a mushrooming of so-called think tanks that sort of, it looked like sort of like a cancer cell dividing, because you had groups like the American Enterprise Institute, which was until about 1985 pretty much a pro-business lobby group. It was nothing particularly interesting. But under its new leadership, by Christopher DeMuth, it turned into a Reaganite propaganda vehicle. It became a bunch of cheerleaders. And now the American Enterprise Institute is one of the Israel lobby's farm teams. And that's where people like Michael Levine and David Wurmser and Robert Bork spew their interminable venom. And so at this point, we see the American Enterprise Institute, we see the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the Canadian Security, the CSP is now led by, what's his name, Frank Gaffney, and a whole host of other organizations funded by other organizations. You have essentially a parallel government developed around the elected government. And this parallel government of think tanks and money from militarist sources, from trusts, and from families who wanted to see the United States become the country it is today, these people started to influence government in a major way. They put out policy papers. They have people appointed to government. In Reagan's first term, I mean, there were 11 people from the Heritage Foundation found their way into government. By the time Clinton gets to power, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy essentially forms his nucleus.
That's right.
And these people are pro-Israel. Now, they're soft pro-Israel. They're probably what you would call labor Zionists. That is to say, they want to kill the Arabs. They want Israel to take over the Middle East. But they want to do it politely. They don't want to draw attention to themselves. So the Kudniks go in with the phosphorus bombs and the cluster bombs, and they tell the world to go stuff itself. They don't care about appearances. And this is what happened in the 1990s, particularly when the Clinton government started to commit all sorts of war crimes in Iraq with the no-fly zones and the economic and military sanctions that caused untold suffering and death, particularly among Iraqi children. What happens is, you see, until Clinton, you see a strengthening and developing of the fascist troika, as I call it, the fascist element. And throughout this period, the Zionist aspect of it starts off almost invisible, but it becomes more and more central. So by the time Clinton takes office, it's pretty much the dominant force.
Yeah.
And Clinton managed to give the illusion that he was working for peace as he was trying to negotiate the destruction of Palestine with Yehud Barak, Shimon Peres, whatever Israeli leader happened to be around at the time. But for the for the real crazies, for the sociopathic, warmongering Looney Tunes, people like Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz and so forth, this wasn't enough. Because Clinton actually wanted a peace of a sort. He wanted an ignoble peace, but he wanted a peace. And that was bad, because peace represents the end of expansionism, and that's something Israel could never accept. And so they go behind Clinton's back in 1997, I believe, or 96 or 97, in my book, with a document called Clean Break, which
yep.
essentially meant that Israel had to break away from its labor Zionist roots and sort of declare itself for what it wants and quit pissing around. And what happened is these clean breakers gave Netanyahu ways to subvert Clinton's own national policy. So essentially, these clean breakers were acting treasonously toward their own government. And at this point, you see the real... America goes on a slide that's very, very quick, because Clinton essentially takes orders from Israel when it comes to the Middle East.
Yeah.
And at this point, the Clinton administration becomes more and more like a satrapy of Israel. And so by the time we end up with the 2000 elections in Al Gore and George W. Bush, we end up with, it becomes a watershed event. The watershed event of the 2000 election could have gone either way, really. I mean, it should have gone to Gore. And had it gone to Gore, we would still have had a pro-Israel policy, but not one that was so abjectly submissive to Israel. Now, what happened with the rise of the PNAC junta that put George Bush into power, and I include in this people like Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, we had essentially the making of a formal coup d'etat, one that essentially was the culmination of the one that happened quietly and imperceptibly, in 1980.
Yep.
See, in 1980, the great tragedy for the United States was that the illusion of America as the champion of justice and liberty and international law and so forth began to grow and grow further apart from the reality of the United States as a selfish, self-interested, petulant child. And the more the United States degenerated into the fascist state of that it is today, the more it allowed itself to be co-opted by the Zionists, the fundamentalist Christians, and the Straussians.
Well, now let me ask you a question, and I think this is probably germane to how they put this together. We all know that our press worldwide, in Europe as well as Canada and America, is controlled by Zionist interests. How did they get the more moderate Zionists, which you talk about with maybe Al Gore and others, to sign on to the more radical form and go unreported? In other words, none of the due diligence that you would expect from a free press has ever been executed in outing any of these policy decisions. And so what we've got here is basically a cheering section in the press for what we've done in the Middle East and what we continue to do. And I'm wondering, was there a concerted effort in Zionism to tell their people within the media to just sit down and be quiet, and we're taking the reins of this, we're taking control now?
I don't know if it was, it might be to some extent. I remember when I was in university, I read a music article about Ronald Reagan. The headline on the front page said, "A disengaged president?" question mark. And this was soon after Reagan became president. And at that time, Donald Regan, who was his chief of staff, went berserk on the editor of Newsweek. And Newsweek never said another discouraging word about Reagan. You see, there was a concerted effort of the press, I believe, to get behind Reagan after they had done so much damage to Nixon. And they were very impolite to Gerald Ford, and they weren't very good to Jimmy Carter. So I think the press got on board with whatever president was elected in 1980 and said, look, we're going to support Reagan, we're not going to criticize him. And if you end up being a supporter of essentially an illegal act, there's a point at which you can't stop doing it. It becomes a narcotic. Once you stop, then you say, well, why did we do it for so long? The issue about Israel in the press and in American culture is a real problem, because the honorable Jews who ran, for example, there's a publication in New York called The Forward, which is a wonderful publication. It's the oldest Jewish publication in the United States. It's one of the best publications for finding out what is going on in the Jewish community. It's outstanding. But a lot of people who are Jewish have been bullied into supporting the Zionist mentality for fear of being demonized as so-called self-hating Jews or anti-Semites, if you can believe the absurdity of that statement.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up with essentially a small clique of bullies and tyrants imposing themselves on a majority, much of the same way the Bolsheviks did in Russia and the way the Nazis did in Germany. The parallels between the Zionist mentality and the Nazi mentality or the Bolshevik mentality are very, very similar. There is no really such thing as a tyranny of the majority, as the Tocqueville spoke about. What we need to worry about is the tyranny of the minority. Because the minority is always too big to be focused on any one thing. The majority is amorphous. The minority is focused, it's dedicated, it's well-drilled, it knows what it wants. And anything that is that sophisticated and that dedicated and that disciplined can get what it wants if it knows how to use terror, coercion, and all sorts of gangster tactics to maximum effect. And in the press, anybody who dares try to speak out against the American policy in the Middle East or tries to expose Israel's criminality is removed for discipline. And we've seen that happen here in Canada. We've seen it in Britain. We've seen it in the United States. And so there are people there who do write about it. It does get into the mainstream press once in a while. But once it does, it's sort of buried. It never develops any legs.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. You see, with September the 11th, here's an example, just digress for a minute. There was plenty of obvious proof that there was no aircraft that struck the Pentagon. It's ridiculous. It's
yeah.
impossible. And here's Jimmy McIntyre of CNN standing in front of the building saying essentially that. Well, Jimmy McIntyre's speech hasn't been seen on CNN since. And so things like this are out there, but they're out there on the fringes where people who find themselves alienated by a press that is dedicated to propagating an official point of view find that that's the only place that they can survive.
But the bottom line is, how could this small minority get so many people that pride themselves in professionalism to turn away from the moral code that a profession demands and essentially become complicit in crime?
Well, that's a good question, and I think you have to ask the journalists about that. And I think it's a combination of ignorance. I think a lot of people who write in the press generally do not know the history of Palestine. They do not know the history of Zionism. They are brought up believing an artificial reality, and they end up regurgitating and defending this artificial reality throughout their life. They don't think that they're doing anything wrong.
Let me ask you something, Greg, on a personal note between you and I. You've been to the French Connections website.
Yeah.
We've worked hard at exposing as much truth as we can. Have you found it to be a powerful source for a lot of information that otherwise would not be found on anywhere else?
I found a lot of the information elsewhere on the web.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much there that I haven't seen before. So as far as uniqueness, I would say no. I follow the career of Stephen Jones, who was hounded by Brigham Young University and is now been forced to take early retirement.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep a track of Stephen Jones on the internet myself, and I've got a call into him, but I haven't heard back. And I would love to get in contact.
Mm-hmm.
But what I find is that when you have a media that's basically conditioned to think in a certain way, it's very, very difficult to change your point of view. And this goes into what I have a section in my book, which I think is a very good, important section, called The True Believer. And this is what happens when you have a person who believes something so devoutly, so totally, that there is no separation, there is no discrete separation between the object of the belief and the believer. to criticize the belief is to criticize the believer. And when you come to this sort of monadistic existence, you end up with a terribly corrupt political culture or media culture, because dissent, honorable dissent, is impossible. And this is what has happened, I think, to a lot of people when you say that, well, Palestine is a legitimate entity. Israel never had a right to exist. It committed mass theft and murder in 1948 and did not do so with the approval of the United Nations, because it didn't. You have to explain to them that terrorism has always been admitted as a necessary tool of Zionism. You have to admit that the United States, Israel committed war crimes and knew they were doing it at the time they were doing it. To tell these people, they will shut their ears because they can't believe what they're hearing. With all their life, they have been brought up with the lie that Israel is a poor, defenseless democracy in a sea of aggressive Arab autocratic regimes. And this is patently false. Because Israel has precipitated every war it ever fought for the sole purpose of killing Arabs and taking Arab land. So you end up with a culture that has been brainwashed.
Yeah.
Essentially lives, if I may use a movie metaphor for a minute, they live in a matrix world where they have taken a blue pill and they accept the world of appearance for reality. They see things as they are and believe that what they see is real. This is a rational world. It's a hyper-rational world. It's a reasonable world. It is a comfortable world. But it's a world that's essentially wrong. Because if you accept the premise that the world is irrational, that what you see is not what really happened or happens, then your entire frame of reference, your entire sense of self, your moral frame of reference collapses. And you end up in a position where you have to ask yourself, what do I believe in? What am I like as a human being? What is truth and what do I know? You end up in a Cartesian dualism that is essentially the essence of the Matrix movie. And the problem for a true believer is that the true believer can never face up to the limitations or the errors of his own belief system, because to do so would be to commit ego suicide. Because there is no discrete separation. There's no intellectual distance between the belief and the believer. There is no critical suspension of this belief for the sake of rationality.
So you know, what I'm seeing here, Greg, is that because people are too mentally weak to be able to step back from their own ignorance, they're gonna destroy a country that has given me and gonna give my family and children a horrible future, and so I find their ignorance to be treasonous.
That's possible, but I think that's unfair. I mean,
no, I don't think it is.
No, well, first of all, if you have a drug addict and someone's addicted to narcotics, and you explain to them that they have to get off their drug, and their reality is a drug-induced stupor, they don't know what reality is. The people who believe, for example, that Israel is a democracy and that they are trying to defend themselves, they are either willfully ignorant or passively ignorant. And the two are quite different. The willfully ignorant are dangerous people. The passively ignorant are also to be pitied, but they're not dangerous. It's the people who willingly lie and propagate the lie. This is why the media is one of the worst aspects of American culture. And here in Canada, too, with a few conspicuous exceptions. We have to be able to have free and open debate on anything. Absolutely anything, without reservation. Everything must be up for discussion. Because unless that has happened, the fundamental lie that sustains the false reality never gets challenged. Because whether we like it or not, we have to undergo some massive withdrawal symptoms if we're ever going to save the United States, or not save it, but reconstitute it, because you can't save a corpse. And to do that, we need to have an honorable, open press. And you cannot criticize Israel, the Holocaust, anything. Because to do so is to be slapped down as an anti-Semite, and you're immediately marginalized, even though there's a very good reason for doing this. And until there is a free press, until the United States re-embraces the notion of freedom of expression, the free press, and the right of the individual to have security from the state, then there is no hope for the United States to resurrect itself.
I agree.
So I think what I'm seeing in the States, what I sense, is that there may be, we may be coming to a point at which the United States, American Republic, American public, I mean, has had enough. There is, in Congress, despite its complicity in everything that Bush Hunter has done, there, I think, is enough of a resistance to the destruction of the American military and the American economy for people to put an end to it. Eventually, the fascist state is untenable over the long term because it is thoroughly exploited. I mean, the fascist government exists and uses the country to support its own private interests. It does not govern on behalf of the public. The public is exploited to serve the fascist interests.
Mm-hmm.
This is clearly what has happened, especially with the robber barons like Halliburton in Iraq, where they essentially plundered the country.
That's right.
And committed all sorts of atrocities too numerous to go into detail over. And I think the United States will have to have some sort of a reckoning. And quite frankly, what I'd like to see happen is a military coup that would suspend or formally declare the Constitution null and void, establish a 5-year military government, a provisional government, and reconstitute the American Republic in some new form. Because unless the American, unless there is a reconciliation between the world of appearance and the world of reality, nothing can happen. And to do that, the entire nation must be forced to take the red pill.
But there's going to be a terrible pogrom of top Jewish fascists that are running our businesses and running and including the Zionist criminals at the top. And there's going to have to be a bloodletting of the top leadership.
Well, what I expect to happen, and what I hope would happen, is that there would be a mass arrest of the Bush junta, every senator and congressman that aided and abetted the war crimes in Iraq and Lebanon, the freezing of all assets of every Zionist organization, and the suspension of their activities. The liquidation of those assets to be given to Arabs and to Palestinians, Lebanese, Iraqis, everyone who has suffered under the hands of the United States as a way of recompense. I mean, for crying out loud, if someone turns up one pfennig in a Swiss bank account that belongs to some German Jew in 1935, we have to go get it. Well, the same thing should apply to the Arabs who have been treated in their own Holocaust, and they have a right to recompense and reconciliation, so they deserve to get what's been stolen from them. And so there has to be a complete purge of the fascist coup that took place with Ronald Reagan. The Zionists, the Strauss-ians, and the evangelical Christians have to be declared persona non grata. They have to be purged from government. And we have to find some way to return the United States to some measure of democratic republican culture. And I don't really know how that's going to happen. Someone like Douglas MacArthur, for example, was the last shogun of Japan, and he had absolute carte blanche to rule that country as he saw fit. And he was a good man, so far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a baseball analogy that may be applicable here. Kennesaw Mountain Landis, a retired judge, was brought out of retirement to become the first baseball commissioner after the infamous Black Sox scandal of 1918. And he was given absolute authority to fix up baseball, not just for the good of the sport, but for the good of the country. And I'm wondering if that might not be necessary in the United States, because at this point, there is no republic. Every American is deemed to be an enemy of the state, unless it can prove otherwise.
That's right.
It is spying on Americans is routine. The right of the Fourth Amendment protection against unlawful search and seizure has been completely abrogated. There is no republic. So for a military coup to establish a 5-star general as the leader of pro tem of the United States would reconcile appearance with reality, and it would tell the American public, you no longer have a country. We have to do something. And that really is how we're going to get the Zionists out of government, is if they are deemed to be war criminals, worthy of prosecution under a Nuremberg-style tribunal, And once we can purge our past, we can face up to what we have done, we can admit it and punish those responsible. But until that happens, the United States cannot continue to go meandering along as it is, pretending that it's a republic, and pretending that everything is as it was before Ronald Reagan took over. And so what I do in my book is I show at the end how this is necessary and why this is necessary. And it's in this background that we see that the September the 11th attack was a planned act to make the fascist republic possible, the fascist state possible. And that the people who benefited from it was Israel and the fascist junta. I don't know to which degree one was more responsible than the other. There's no evidence one way or the other of it. But there is.
Well, I don't see any evidence that one isn't the other.
Well, that's true. I mean, within the junta, there are, in the junta element of the Christian design of the Faustians, they are sympathetic. But they're not mutually identifiable in all cases. I mean, there are differences. But with respect to Dick Cheney, who I think bears the ultimate responsibility for this, as well as Rumsfeld, there has to be some accounting. And
we think here at the French Connection, all of roads lead way beyond, way higher. And, of course, unless we stop the people that ordered these actions in America and financed them through deception and lies, and founded Israel in the first place, and continue to offer immigrants $50,000 per immigrant coming from a family here in Europe that we have outed in many ways. We're never going to stop this mess until we get to the top, because those people are still going to be pulling the strings from behind the scenes. And lo and behold, any military dictator that goes in to try to do a good job is going to get usurped by these people again. As Andrew Johnson was, you can go back in history and see how 1913's Federal Reserve Act was put in through by illegal means. These people don't care about the rules that we try to set up in America. They will usurp them and put in their own people anyway.
Well, I know this argument. I don't subscribe to it, first of all. And I don't think we have to go that far. I mean, it's enough, I think, to look at Cheney and what happened in the United States with the rise of the fascist coup of 1980. I think we don't have to go beyond that, I think, to appreciate what happened on September the 11th. And that if, in fact, a military provisional government does take place in the United States, I don't think it would allow itself to be co-opted in that manner. I think the time has passed for that.
I think it would have Rothschild's fingers all over it.
I don't buy the Rothschild argument, but I haven't looked into it that closely, but I think it sounds a bit too pat. I don't really think it's that relevant to this issue.
Well, I really think you're wrong about that, and I think if you look behind the scenes of where the financial power is coming, I'll give you a couple of good examples right now. The laws that have been passed in America about the control of water, just for one example. Water systems in the United States used to be municipally owned. Then they were privatized. They were privatized under Ronald Reagan, believe it or not. From Ronald Reagan's period forward, those water systems in 60 of America's largest cities have been turned over to an entirely owned company owned by Rothschild. And now, Greg, they have just passed laws that are going to stop people who own water rights under their property from pumping their own water, and it's going to be deemed back to the government to control that. And what you have to understand is companies like U.S. Filter, companies like Suez Lyonnais des Eaux, companies like BNP Paribas, the largest bank in the world today, companies like Lazard Frere that are the first company to do business in China and the largest bank in the world, you cannot ignore these relationships. And in fact, if you get further into this, you'll start finding out that Apex money comes from these sources, and you'll start finding out that most Zionist organizations have money funneled in from Europe and old Jewish money. It comes from Oppenheimer. It comes from Warburg. It comes from Rothschild. It comes from Levy. I can go on. Con Loeb. And when you start looking at the machinations of 9/11, you can find roots to this. And you can find it with Ronald Lauder connections. You can go all the way back to Herzliya and the establishment of the Mossad with Rothschild money. And once you start taking this step, then you start really looking at the real criminals. And do you understand my point here?
Yeah, I understand your point. But for the purposes of my interest in writing my book, I don't find it important to go into this because it's possible to understand what happened in the United States without getting involved with the Rothschild banking system. I mean, I look at the United States, I look at the selfish Christians and the Zionists and the...
They're just the troops that these people used.
Well, as I say, I don't have any evidence for that. I've heard the arguments, I've seen some writing, I haven't confirmed it to my satisfaction. And so until I can prove it to my own satisfaction, I don't get into theories
Well, you don't need to look any further than the Federal Reserve banking system and having the Schiff, the Honigs, the Loeb cons, and all of the people working directly under the auspices of Rothschild controlling the money system. And it is that money system that has permitted the craziness to take place. If you take a look at what happened from Reagan on under Greenspan and others, you will find out that the money system has been instrumental in permitting what happened. And without that, it would not have been possible. And when you understand who controls it, then you understand the people behind it.
Well, let's say Ronald Reagan himself subscribes to the sort of the radical individualism, the anti-statist mentality that grew out of the 1960s and 70s. And it's possible to look at it as that would be enough to explain why, for example, municipal water systems are privatized. Now, who they're sold to, that's another story, and that's nothing that I've gone into, so I'm not really in a position to comment on that. My book, strictly speaking, looks at the decline and fall of the American Republic, and does so from the coup d'etat of 1980, and it shows how the fascist element got into American government, and how that now has reached its highest expression.
Well, see, we believe that the French Connection, that fascist government was put there, and by the forces I just enunciated.
Well, I don't believe that, and I see no evidence to support it.
I believe it. I believe it wholeheartedly, and all you need to do is follow the financial trail, and that financial trail goes back to the people I just told you about.
You may be right. As I say, I've not investigated it, but I can't comment on something I haven't investigated.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
What I will say is that, for my purposes, it is my book is a complete treatment of what happened between Reagan and Bush.
Yep.
And in that book, The Host and the Parasite, shows how the parasitic element of the fascists, led by the Zionist element, ultimately managed to grab hold of the United States and metastasize through every aspect of American society and government. And I think once we look at that, and we understand that, and we even go beyond that if you want and find other deeper meaning in it. But for my purposes, that shows, and it is enough to show the discontinuity between image and reality, which is what happened
mm-hmm.
in 1976. The American Republic died the minute that Ford left office. And it was on life support in a coma, I think, for about 4 years. And then when Ronald Reagan came to power, that was it. It started to degenerate into a fascist state. And that is essentially the thesis that I've advanced in the book. I've got 20, 30 pages of footnotes. And much of the information is...
Well, I want you to do this, but we're gonna end the interview. But I want you to give the details again, how people can get the book, what your publisher's name is, and when it's coming out, so that they can look forward to getting this information, Greg. And what we're going to do here, and I'm going to invite you back to go further than this at another date, and we'll talk in advance, and we'll discuss putting out more information than we just been through. But I like to do this in 1 hour chunks, and we've hit that already. So why don't you give that information out, my friend?
Sure. The book is called The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America. It's published by Dandelion Books, and the publishing date is not yet firm. It should be out late November, early December, but it should be out well before Christmas, so it'll make a great gift. So that's what
yeah. If you know what, maybe more people are starting to become willing to read more truthful information, and I do feel that that is happening.
You know, you're right about that, and this is why a good friend of mine who I correspond with thought that my title was too provocative and it would put off people. But I've been reading considerably on the internet about other people in the mainstream press and in some of the alternative media, and the time is right now. To criticize Israel directly.
Yeah.
I mean, Israel has made itself a political football. It has been implicated in the Abu Ghraib torture scandal. It has been implicated in committing war crimes in Lebanon. It's just admitted to using phosphorus bombs, which are illegal despite what it tries to tell you. Israel is committing atrocities in Palestine. And when ever since Yasser Arafat refused to be stampeded into signing an ignoble agreement, Israel has been on the defensive. It has lost its momentum, it's lost its credibility, it has lost its integrity.
Can I tell you also, Greg,
that the
epithet of anti-Semite is losing its sting as well.
Oh, I know. I mean, the anti-Semite, I mean, for crying out loud, you have people who are Jews being called anti-Semites. I don't know who it was, and I wish I could remember his name, but someone said that anti-Semite is not someone who hates Jews, it's someone a Jew hates.
And, there you go.
And I think that's a very good description of it. I wrote an essay, I'll be looking for in a second, on 2001, called Israel, a Monument to Anti-Semitism. And that particular piece of writing got thrown around the world several times, and I've never had a response to any article like I've had to that one. It's been picked up, it's been used in papers, it's been found its way into books. And what I've done there is I've demonstrated how Israel is the root of anti-Semitism, the anti-Jewish mentality.
Yep.
It's on my website, gregfelton.com, and it's also on mediamonitors.net.
Well, what we're going to do, Greg, we're going to put links to this, and we'll put the information that you've given in here in the interview. And we'll do another interview sometime in the future. I'll get in touch with you.
Okay.
But I want to let you know that we're here to dig through these facts, and we do have more information probably than you've read on some of these things that I just discussed with you. And one of this, we just did another author named his name is Andrew Hitchcock. Sorry, Andrew. And he did a timeline for the Rothschilds, and I think you'll find a lot of information in there. That would be helpful to you to understand how their financing and how their goals intermesh with this group that you've just so well described in this interview. I mean, you'll find out that they're not exclusive to each other, but rather, you know, that they're working together in this.
Well, the thing is, let's say in my book, I go into the definition of fascism, and I look at it, the elements that Professor Lawrence Britt described, the 14 points of fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at each one exactly to a T depicts the United States today.
Yep.
So by definition, it is a fascist state. And within that fascist government, there are at times competing elements. There is friction between the Zionists, robber barons and the Zionists. There is a friction there. There is friction between the Christians and the Straussians in some regards. I mean, there are areas of overlap, there are areas of contention. It's not a perfect symbiosis, but it is strong enough, like a triangle, where each angle has to support the other at key points. And depends how you turn the apex as to which one you think is at the top. I argue that the Zionist element is at the top.
Yeah, it is.
That is driving the United States, because it is the one that is forcing the United States to act contrary to self-interest.
And you'll also find it running our Defense Department through Dov Zolkheim. And you'll also find it its religious angle through Lubavitchers are doing things. You will find Zionism rearing its ugly head in almost every element. And it's bizarre to me, Greg, that I can see spies being caught in America. We had Mossad agents on 9/11 all over the place, arrested them weeks after, and sent them all packing home.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me.
Well, you know, we had art students, so-called art students, all over this mess. And interesting, they stopped a few vans and found bomb residue in their vans.
Yeah, I saw that. I got that in my book.
And it's, isn't that interesting that nobody, you know, nobody did any looking into this?
Well, again, this is the problem where you have a government that's essentially co-opted by a foreign agency. And this is why the Americans have to understand that they no longer have a country.
Yeah.
And they need the military to help them get it back. Because at this point, the American military won't exist in about 10 years.
Because that's right.
Dead.
Yep.
And right now you've got press gangs, you know, even taking people who are mentally unstable and pressing them into service because recruiters can't meet their target. I mean, it's becoming insane. The American military, which once was the pride of the United States, has become reduced to a death squad.
Yes, it's a bunch of murderers. That's what's happening.
And, I mean, soldiers like Anthony Zinni, who's a decent, honorable man, told Rummy that he couldn't fight the war with simply 100, with the number of troops he was sending over. He'd need about 700,000. And Rumsfeld basically kept the roof and came down screaming. And, of course, Zinni was right. But Rumsfeld doesn't want to be told the truth. He wants to be told what he wants to hear. And that's essentially the essence of the fascists, is that they don't care about what really is. They care about what they want it to be. And the American military is going to die. And once the military starts hurting, you'll see change. Because it is the military that will really be the engine for change in America. Because no government can survive without the support of the armed forces. And once the armed forces start suffering, you'll see change. And it may be a bloody change. It may be like Kent State over the entire country. We may see a 5,000 Kent State erupt in the United States. I don't know. It might be a bloody coup. Or it could be a bloodless coup like it was in St. Petersburg when Lenin took power. But something will happen. And the fascist government, the Israel hammerlock on the United States, is coming to an end. And it will come to an end because at some point, when you've gone into the sewer as deep as you can go and you've committed every atrocity imaginable, you can't sink any lower.
Well, I've often wondered how low we can go, and it keeps surprising me, Greg.
It does. You know, it surprises me, too. And it doesn't hurt, doesn't help that Israel has 200 warheads pointed at the European capitals.
Yeah.
And the nuclear blackmail of Israel is something that has to be addressed in a major way.
Well, we're going to talk about this at another time, but I want to thank you again, Greg Felton, for being on The French Connection today. And I look forward to talking to you again.